Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Continuing from where we left off last show, whether risk management might seem like an odd industry, but Bates reports that this weather risk management market far outweighs the USA's commercial weather products market, which in 2000 was estimated at approximately $500 million a year, touching over $45 billion in the years 2005 and 2006. Welcoming corporate involvement in open data activities leads to new Amazons and Apples, while undermining the community activism that is the movement's strong point. One of the leading companies in the open data space is Palantir's Technologies. It was highlighted by the Civic Minded Code for America. It sponsors O'Reilly Government Summit and adopts his government as the platform terminology, and was an early partner in USAID's Food Security Open Data Challenge. Palantir received early funding from the CIA's InQtel venture capital arm and from Peter Thiel's Founders Fund, both organizations known for their deep commitment to openness and equality. Peter Thiel is Palantir's chairman of the board. Perhaps he will be pursuing open data projects for the secretive Bilderberg Group, on whose steering committee he sits. It would be nice to think that the shift to open data might undermine some vested interests without reanimating Animal Farm, but the prospects are not bright. One lesson of cultural economics is that creative works for which there is significant demand in a small market can be swamped by near-zero marginal cost exports from large markets. It is more profitable for TV stations in smaller markets to broadcast cheap American shows than it is to broadcast more expensive homegrown material, even in cases where the latter would draw a bigger audience. Because cultural producers seek to cover their costs in their home market and typically sell at discounted rates elsewhere. To maintain cultural diversity in the face of winner-take-all markets, governments in smaller countries have designed a toolbox of interventions. The contents include production subsidies, broadcast quotas, spending rules, national ownership, and competition policies. In general, such measures have received support from those with left-leaning outlooks. Unfortunately, the open data movement demands that data be provided without borders and in a uniform way, machine processable, available to anyone, and license free. It mandates non-discriminatory licensing focusing on standards-based formats and generally insists that data be accessible to the rich and to the poor alike, like justice and the writs. It insists that any measures government would like to take to favor, for example, non-commercial users or local users, be taken off the table. For open data to be a public good, it must be accompanied by social changes. If the goal of the movement is to promote equality, it will need to be to have more emphasis on experimentation in standards, licensing, and the selective provision of data at all levels of government. Otherwise, what is potentially valuable public resources will simply be plundered by those with the digital skills and resources to make the most use of it. Many successful open movements grow in a consistent pattern. The movement starts by appealing to egalitarian ideals and relies on claims that openness can redress the balance with powerful institutions, such as incumbent corporations or the state. As an openness movement grows, the smart money learns how to work with it. Sometimes that smart money comes from those who seems to be threatened. IBM was an establishment software company with its own operating system, which learned to love Linux, and the music industry learns to put ads on and in YouTube music videos. So businesses grow around the open commons. Big companies are often better placed to influence the development of the movement than the amateurs who appear in their stories. Alliances with such companies, such as Blockbuster Strategies and Anita Elberser's phrase, can be tempting for openness initiatives and are often accompanied by a change in language. Visions of community are replaced by arguments that openness provides a better experience for consumers or is a more efficient production method. In the open data world, arguments for citizen engagement put a one side in favor of arguments about new consumer services, Google Maps, real estate listings. Linux's goal of providing users with more control over the computing environment takes a second place to powering Wall Street and the U.S. security state. The same pattern happens with online platforms. eBay is the ancestor of sharing economy companies, and many people still think of it as everyone's garage sale. But the company itself now describes its history in three phases. The first is the garage sale phrase, and the second was of professional small vendors making a living from the marketplace. That too has been superseded as the major brands that now use eBay. The auction model that lent the site its informal bartering atmosphere has long gone. Most of the purchases now of new goods rather than secondhand. And with sharing economy companies, the belief that the free market economies and commons-based or community-based social exchanges are compatible means that commercial success and the ambition to grow eat away at the very characteristics that give them their early appeal. This new world can be good for us in our role as consumers, but it is bad for producers and distributors who are trying to make money from their work and now become portrayed as obstacles to progress. Open source developers are often in a relatively good space in that they can get paid for working in the new businesses that surround open source software. But for journalists, photographers, and filmmakers, the message for them is that they have to give up the idea that they somehow deserve to be paid for their work. The new world is best for all for the Web 2.0 platform owners who have every reason not to ask themselves whether what they have delivered fits what they have promised. Chapter 8. Open Wide. Silicon Valley is deeply committed to the idea of sharing and commerce, that sharing and commerce go together. Beyond the sharing economy, there are many examples, such as which we saw in Chapter 7. Lawrence Lessig's idea of the hybrid economy relies on amateurs and professionals working side by side, often for for-profit platforms. Social enterprises are organizations that apply commercial strategies to maximize improvements in human and environmental well-being. Benefit corporations such as Etsy, the online craft trading marketplace, are firms that want to consider society and the environment in addition to profit in their decision-making processes. The related idea of social entrepreneurship uses markets to scale up efforts to create social good. Groups such as Markets for Good, a wing of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Google.org, the charitable arm of Google, put these ideas into practice. Stephen Berlin Johnson's idea of peer progressives was mentioned in Chapter 1. It highlights both for-profit and not-for-profit peer-to-peer networks as a framework for solving social problems, and it seeks to position digital platforms and their communities for social good. Pierre Omidyar is one of the most vocal proponents of social enterprise models. Omidyar founded eBay, one of the direct ancestors of the sharing economy. eBay took what was a neighborhood activity, namely the yard sale, and scaled it up by putting it on the internet with massive successes. eBay made Pierre Omidyar a billionaire, and he has put his money to active use together with his wife, Pam Omidyar, and he created the Omidyar Network, which blurs the line between giving and investing. It calls itself a philanthropic investment firm, and the line between profit and social good, namely it invests in entrepreneurs who share our commitment to advancing social good. It is dedicated to harnessing the power of markets to create opportunity for people to improve their lives. A common thread of these initiatives, many of which are linked to successful technology entrepreneurs, is that they insist entrepreneurship, rather than, for example, service, is the right way to solve social problems. They believe profit and social good can not only coexist, but can benefit each other so long as the motivations of those in charge are pure. In the world outside of Silicon Valley, views about the effects of markets on other forms of social interaction are mixed. two traditions reach back to the 18th century and the ideas of Adam Smith. One sees the market as civilizing, harnessing Smith's belief that is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from the regard of their own self-interest. Another sees the market as corrupting and prefers a different quote from Adam Smith, quote, "People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion. But the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public, or in some contrivance to raise prices." Along other dimensions, some see the market as feeble in its effects on society, whether particularly civilizing nor destructive, while others, like Midyar, see markets and mechanisms for bringing about desired social and political change. This chapter looks at how efforts to combine profit and sharing have worked out in two areas that are particularly important to the sharing economy, on the internet and in cities. Crowding out. Sharing economy exchanges are supposed to have two components, namely economy, which refers to the market exchange between a service provider and a consumer, but sharing invokes a more personal and empathetic exchange, like neighbors helping neighbors. Money may be involved, but the exchange is about more than money. It's about connections and it's about community. Chapter 4 referred to the common trope among technology commentators and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to describe history in three states: an age of personal exchange and civic involvement is followed by an era of alienating mass consumption and mass production that is followed in turn by a resurgence of civic and community-based involvement-driven new technologies. It's an arc that pulls from some well-respected research on the late 20th century fall-off in civil involvement, most notably Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, but which too often ends up as a caricature. Here is Brian Chesky's version. Quote, "Cities used to be generally villages, and everyone was essentially kind of like an entrepreneur. You were either a farmer, or you worked in the city as a blacksmith, or you were in some kind of trade. And then the Industrial Revolution happened. World War II followed, and suddenly cities became more and more mass-produced, and we stopped trusting our neighbors. Even following the collapse of community, non-commercial activities are so much a part of our fabric of our daily lives that it's not easy to notice them. But our neighborhoods and our cities continue to depend on civic action. And those who think about profit and sharing in the digital world can learn lots from our cities and from our cultures." A few years ago, Clay Shirsky wrote that it had taken 100 million hours to create Wikipedia and wondered what we could do with this newly discovered cognitive surplus. It's an impressive number, but like so many big numbers, it is less impressive when you put it in perspective. To take one example, Canadians volunteered over 2.1 billion hours in the year 2010 alone, and there's no reason to suppose that Canada is more volunteer-minded than other countries. That's the equivalent of over 1 million full-time jobs or 20 complete Wikipedias spent in hospitals, sports teams, charitables, and art organizations. Practices of non-commercial sharing and collaboration are still pervasive in our cities, and much of what we call culture has long been marked by a combination of voluntary sharing and monetary work, from sports to the arts to the social practices of our everyday lives. In a simplistic economic view, money is interchangeable with other motivations, So the idea of adding monetary incentives to encourage and amplify social exchanges sounds obvious. It's a style of argument that was pursued most actively by Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker, one of the most influential economists in the 20th century. But in social exchanges, as Sidney Lauper sang, money changes everything. In a famous study called The Gift Relationship, Richard Titmuss compared the American and British systems of blood donation and concluded that the introduction of monetary incentives in the U.S. has lowered the frequency of donations because, quote, allowing a market in blood changes the social understanding of blood donation from the gift of life to a mere cash equivalent. Giving blood for nothing is something you can feel good about. Giving blood for money is not. Instead of increasing the incentives to perform this social act, money crowded out the intrinsic motivations that had led people to donate. Titmuss showed that monetary incentives also lowered the quality of donated blood. People giving blood for social reasons will naturally avoid giving if they do not meet the blood system's requirements, but people giving for money are more likely to give even if their blood may be dangerous to recipients. Screening becomes far more important in these cases.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. We are now in chapter 8 and continuing. Titmuss showed that monetary incentives often lowered the quality of donated blood. People giving blood for social reasons will naturally avoid giving if they do not meet blood systems requirements. But people giving for money are more likely to give even if their blood is dangerous to recipients. Screening becomes much more important. There are many other examples where money and gifts are not interchangeable. Sending flowers after a date means one thing. Leaving a $50 bill means something else entirely. Offering someone money to step ahead of them in a supermarket queue is unlikely to be successful. Paying money for votes is incompatible with the democratic process. The ultimatum game, a simple two-player exercise that illustrates cultural notions of fairness, shows why alienation increases along with the money involved. In this game, a pot of $100 is assigned to one player, who must make a take-it-or-leave-it offer of a portion of the pot to the second player. The size of the offer is up to the first player. If the second player accepts the offer, then both take their portion of the pot. But if the second player rejects the offer, then the pot must be returned and both players are left penniless. It turns out that many second players reject small offers, even though it means losing money, rather than see the first player get away with being greedy. Ideals of fairness cause people to turn their backs on what would, in other circumstances, be a good offer. $10 for free, namely. Sharing economy companies ignore the ways that money crowds out social exchange. Uber is well known for its surge pricing approach to dealing with supply and demand. Some critics object to it, and customers faced with high fares have been quick to record their displeasure. But economists, as well as Uber itself, are quick to explain, often as if to a slow child, that it's just the natural law of supply and demand. With surge pricing, Uber rates increase to get more cars on the road and ensure reliability during the busiest times. When enough cars are on the road, prices go back down to normal levels. In their defense, Uber's surge pricing is far from new. Even in the world of transit, bus fares and train fares are more expensive at peak times in many cities, and airlines adjust pricing depending on how many seats they want to sell. But Uber and too many economists are blind to a different aspect of this debate, which is that surge pricing on New Year's Eve or at rush hour is one thing, but surge pricing during snowstorms is something else. At times of emergency, we commonly rely on people pulling together to get us through crises. We expect people to check on their neighbors for free, to help people who are stuck without charging, and to generally pitch in to be community-minded. We expect people to share their time and their possessions. Emphasizing monetary incentives during a crisis crowds out community motives. If my neighbor and I push your car out of a snowbank without payment, then we're just doing the right thing. But if my neighbor is being paid and I'm doing it for free, then I'm just a sucker. There's a reason that profiting from emergencies is called price gouging, and is because of the broader situation that demands a community-driven response that the monetary incentives of supply and demand only undermine, regardless of its impact on the number of Uber vehicles on the ground. At a time of crisis, surge pricing may put more cars on the street, but they are not available for those who cannot afford the prices. We object to surge pricing at such a time for the same reason that we would object to lifeboats being made available only for first-class passengers in the Titanic. At times of emergency, equitable access is a strong requirement. Uber is deaf to such arguments, as might be expected from a company founded by a follower of Ayn Rand. Even Uber had to back down after a 2014 hostage crisis in Sydney's Central Business District, a tragedy that left 3 people dead. During the confusion of the early stages of the crisis, as people fled the center of the city, Uber hiked prices by up to a factor of 4, at one point charging a minimum fare of $100. Certainly a very questionable policy. We'll be exploring this and many other interesting ideas from this book in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.